It took practice and was difficult, but Vin was getting better at reading the pulses. She focused. Breeze was burning brass, the internal mental pushing metal. And Vin focused harder. She could feel a pattern washing over her, a double dum-dum beat with each pulse. They felt oriented to her right. The pulses were washing against something else, something that was sucking them in. Elend. Breeze was focused on Elend. Not surprising, considering the current discussion. Breeze was always pushing on the people he interacted with. Satisfied, Vin sat back. But then she paused. Marsh implied there was much more to Bronze than many people thought. I wonder... She squeezed her eyes shut, ignoring the fact that any of the others who saw her would think her actions strange, and focused again on the alimentic pulses. She flared the bronze, concentrating so hard she felt she'd give herself a headache. There was a vibration to the pulses. But what that could mean, she wasn't certain. Focus, she told herself. However, the pulses stubbornly refused to yield any further information. Fine, she thought. I'll cheat. She turned off her tin, she almost always had it on a little bit, then reached inside and burned the 14th metal, Duralumin. The alimentic pulses became so loud, so powerful, she swore she could feel their vibrations shaking her apart. They pounded like beats from a massive drum set right beside her. But she got something from them. Anxiety, nervousness, worry, insecurity, anxiety, nervousness, worry. It was gone. Her bronze expended in one massive flare of power. Vin opened her eyes. No one in the room was looking at her except Orsure. She felt drained. The headache she'd predicted before now came in full force, thudding inside her head like the tiny brother of the drum she'd now banished. However, she held to the information she'd gleaned. It hadn't come in words, but feelings. And her first fear was that Breeze was making these emotions appear. Anxiety, nervousness, worry. However, she immediately realized that Breeze was a soother. If he focused on emotions, it would be the ones he was dampening, the ones he was using his powers to soothe away. She looked from him to Elend. Why, he's making Elend more confident. If Elend stood a little taller, it was because Breeze was quietly helping, soothing away anxiety and worry. And Breeze did this even as he argued and made his usual mocking comments. Vin studied the plump man, ignoring her headache, feeling a newfound sense of admiration. She'd always wondered just a little at Breeze's placement in the crew. The other men were all, to an extent, idealists. Even Clubs, beneath his crotchety exterior, had always struck her as a solidly good man. Breeze was different. Manipulative, a little selfish, he seemed like he'd joined the crew for the challenge, not because he really wanted to help the Ska. But Kelsier had always claimed that he'd chosen his crew carefully, picking the men for their integrity, not just their skill. Perhaps Breeze wasn't an exception after all. Vin watched him pointing his cane at Ham as he said something flippant. And yet on the inside, he was completely different. You're a good man, Breeze, she thought, smiling to herself. You just try your best to hide it. And he also wasn't the imposter. She'd known that before, of course. Breeze hadn't been in the city when the Chandra had made the switch. However, having a second confirmation lifted a tiny bit of her burden. Now, if she could just eliminate some of the others. Elend bid the crew farewell after the meeting. Doxson went to pen the requested letters, Ham to go over security, Clubs back to training the soldiers, and Breeze to try and placate the assembly regarding Ellen's lack of attention. Vin trailed out of the study, shooting him a glance, then eyeing Tyndall. Suspicious of her still, eh? Elend thought with amusement. He nodded reassuringly, and Vin frowned, looking just a little annoyed. He would have let her stay, but, well, facing Tyndall was embarrassing enough alone. Vin left the room, Wolfhound Chandra at her side. Looks like she's growing more attached to the creature, Elend thought with satisfaction. It was good to know that someone watched over her. Vin shut the door behind her, and Elend sighed, rubbing his shoulder. Several weeks of training with the sword and cane were taking a lot out of him, and his body was bruised. He tried to keep the pain from showing, or rather from letting Tyndall see him show the pain. At least I proved that I'm learning, he thought. She had to see how well I did today. Well? He asked. You are an embarrassment, Tyndall said, standing before her chair. So you like to say, Elend said, walking forward to begin piling up a stack of books. Tyndall said that he needed to let servants keep his study clean, something he'd always resisted. The clutter of books and papers felt right to him, and he certainly didn't want someone else moving them around. With her standing there looking at him, however, it was difficult not to feel self-conscious about the mess. He stacked another book on the pile. "Surely you noticed how well I did," Elend said. "I got them to let me go into Straff's camp." "You are king, Elend Venture," Tyndall said, arms folded. "Nobody lets you do anything. The first change in attitude has to be your own. You have to stop thinking that you need permission or agreement from those who follow you." "A king should lead by consent of his citizens," Elend said. "I will not be another lord ruler." "A king should be strong," Tyndall said firmly. "He accepts counsel, but only when he asks for it. He makes it clear that the final decision is his, not his counselor's. You need better control over your advisers. If they don't respect you, then your enemies won't either, and the masses never will." "Ham and the others respect me," Tyndall raised an eyebrow. "They do." "What do they call you?" Elend shrugged. "They're my friends. They use my name." "Or a close approximation of it. Right, El?" Elend flushed, setting one final book on the stack. "You'd have me force my friends to address me by my title?" "Yes," Tyndall said. "Especially in public. You should be addressed as Your Majesty, or at least as my lord." "I doubt Ham would deal well with that," Elend said. "He has some issues with authority." "He will get over them," Tyndall said, wiping her finger along a bookcase. She didn't need to hold it up for Elend to know there would be dust on its tip. "What about you?" Elend challenged.
"Me?"
"You call me Elend Venture, not Your Majesty."
"I am different," Tyndall said.
"Well, I don't see why you should be. You can call me Your Majesty from now on." Tyndall smiled slyly.
"Very well, Your Majesty. You can unclench your fists now. You're going to have to work on that. A statesman should not give visual clues of his nervousness."
Elend glanced down, relaxing his hands.
"All right." "In addition," Tyndall continued, "you still hedge too much in your language. It makes you seem timid and hesitant."
"I'm working on that."
"Don't apologize unless you really mean it," Tyndall said. "And don't make excuses. You don't need them. A leader is often judged by how well he bears responsibility. As king, everything that happens in your kingdom, regardless of who commits the act, is your fault. You are even responsible for unavoidable events, such as earthquakes or storms."
"Or armies," Elend said. Tyndall nodded.
"Or armies. It is your responsibility to deal with these things, and if something goes wrong, it is your fault. You simply have to accept this."
Elend nodded, picking up a book.
"Now, let's talk about guilt," Tyndall said, seating herself. "Stop cleaning. That isn't a job for a king."
Elend sighed, setting down the book.
"Guilt," Tyndall said, "does not become a king. You have to stop feeling sorry for yourself."
"You just told me everything that happens in the kingdom is my fault."
"It is. How can I not feel guilty, then?
You have to feel confident that your actions are the best, Tyndall explained. You have to know that no matter how bad things get, they would be worse without you.
When disaster occurs, you take responsibility. But you don't wallow or mope. You aren't allowed that luxury. Guilt is for lesser men. You simply need to do what is expected.
And that is?
To make everything better.
Great, Ellen said flatly. And if I fail?
Then you accept responsibility and make everything better on the second try.
Ellen rolled his eyes.
And what if I can't ever make things better? What if I'm really not the best man to be king?
Then you remove yourself from the position, Tyndall said. Suicide is the preferred method, assuming, of course, that you have an heir. A good king knows not to foul up the succession.
Of course, Ellen said. So you're saying I should just kill myself?
No. I'm telling you to have pride in yourself, Your Majesty.
That's not what it sounds like. Every day you tell me how poor a king I am, and how my people will suffer because of it. Tyndall, I'm not the best man for this position. He got himself killed by the Lord Ruler.
That is enough, Tyndall snapped. Believe it or not, Your Majesty, you are the best person for this position.
Ellen snorted.
You are best, Tyndall said, because you hold the throne now. If there is anything worse than a mediocre king, it is chaos, which is what this kingdom would have if you hadn't taken the throne. The people on both sides, noblemen and Scar, accept you. They may not believe in you, but they accept you. Step down now, or even die accidentally, and there would be confusion, collapse, and destruction. Poorly trained or not, weak of character or not, mocked or not, you are all this country has. You are king, Ellen Venture.
Ellen paused.
I'm not sure if you're making me feel any better about myself, Tyndall.
It's...
Ellen raised a hand.
Yes, I know. It's not about how I feel.
You have no place for guilt. Except that you're king, except that you can do nothing constructive to change that, and accept responsibility. Whatever you do, be confident. For if you weren't here, there would be chaos.
Ellen nodded.
Arrogance, Your Majesty, Tyndall said. Successful leaders all share one common trait. They believe that they can do a better job than the alternatives. Humility is fine when considering your responsibility and duty. But when it comes time to make a decision, you must not question yourself.
I'll try.
Good, Tyndall said. Now, perhaps we can move on to another matter. Tell me why you haven't married that young girl.
Ellen frowned.
Wasn't expecting that. That's a very personal question, Tyndall.
Good.
Ellen deepened his frown, but she sat expectantly, watching him with one of her unrelenting stares.
I don't know,
Ellen finally said, sitting back in his chair, sighing.
Vin isn't... like other women.
Tyndall raised an eyebrow, her voice softening slightly.
I think that the more women you come to know, Your Majesty, the more you'll find that statement applies to all of them.
Ellen nodded ruefully.
Either way, Tyndall said, things are not well as they stand. I will not pry further into your relationship, but... as we've discussed, appearances are very important to a king. It isn't appropriate for you to be seen as having a mistress. I realize that sort of thing was common for imperial nobility. The Ska, however, want to see something better in you. Perhaps because many noblemen were so frivolous with their sexual lives, the Ska have always prized monogamy. They wish desperately for you to respect their values.
They'll just have to be patient with us, Ellen said. I actually want to marry Vin, but she won't have it.
Do you know why?
Ellen shook his head.
She...
doesn't seem to make sense a lot of the time. Perhaps she isn't right for a man in your position.
Ellen looked up sharply. What does that mean?
Perhaps you need someone a little more refined, Tyndall said. I'm certain she's a fine bodyguard. But as a lady, she...
Stop! Ellen snapped. Vin is fine as she is.
Tyndall smiled.
What?
Ellen demanded.
I've insulted you all afternoon, Your Majesty, and you barely grew sullen. I mentioned your Mistborn in a mildly disparaging way, and now you're ready to throw me out.
So?
So? You do love her?
Of course, Ellen said. I don't understand her, but yes, I love her.
Tyndall nodded.
I apologize, then, Your Majesty. I had to be certain.
Ellen frowned, relaxing in his chair slightly.
So, this was some kind of test, then? You wanted to see how I would react to your words about Vin?
You will always be tested by those you meet, Your Majesty. You might as well grow accustomed to it.
But why do you care about my relationship with Vin?
Love is not easy for kings, Your Majesty,
Tyndall said in an uncharacteristically kind voice.
You will find that your affection for the girl can cause far more trouble than any of the other things we've discussed.
And that's a reason to give her up?
Ellen asked stiffly.
No,
Tyndall said.
No, I don't think so.
Ellen paused, studying the stately terrace woman with her square features and her stiff posture.
That seems odd coming from you. What about kingly duty and appearances?
We must make allowances for the occasional exception, Tyndall said.
Interesting, Ellen thought. He wouldn't have considered her the type to agree to any sort of exceptions.
Perhaps she's a little deeper than I've assumed.
Now, Tyndall said, how are your training sessions going?
Ellen rubbed his sore arm.
All right, I suppose, but...
He was interrupted by a knock at the door. Captain Dumoux entered a moment later.
Your Majesty... A visitor has arrived from Lord Set's army.
A messenger?
Ellen said, standing. Dumoux paused, looking a little embarrassed.
Well, sort of. She says she's Lord Set's daughter, and she's come looking for Breeze.
He was born of a humble family, yet married the daughter of a king.
21. The young woman's expensive dress, light red silk with a shawl and lace sleeves, might have lent her an air of dignity had she not scampered forward as soon as Breeze entered the room. Her light western hair bouncing, she made a squeal of happiness as she threw her arms around Breeze's neck. She was perhaps 18 years old. Ellen glanced at Ham, who stood dumbfounded.
Well... Looks like you were right about Breeze and Set's daughter, Ellen whispered.
Ham shook his head.
I didn't think... I mean, I joked because it was Breeze. But I didn't expect to be right.
Breeze, for his part, at least had the decency to look terribly uncomfortable in the young woman's arms. They stood inside the palace atrium, the same place where Ellen had met with his father's messenger. Floor-to-ceiling windows let in the afternoon light, and a group of servants stood at one side of the room to wait on Ellen's orders. Breeze met Ellen's eyes, blushing deeply.
I don't think I've ever seen him do that before, Ellen thought.
My dear, Breeze said, clearing his throat, perhaps you should introduce yourself to the king?
The girl finally let go of Breeze. She stepped back, curtsying to Ellen with a noblewoman's grace. She was a bit plump, her hair long after pre-collapse fashion, and her cheeks were red with excitement. She was a cute thing, obviously well-trained for the court, exactly the sort of girl that Ellen had spent his youth trying to avoid.
Elland, Breeze said, might I introduce Orianne Set, daughter to Lord Ashweather Set, King of the Western Dominance?
Your Majesty, Orianne said.
Elland nodded.
Lady Set?
He paused, then, with a hopeful voice, continued.
Your father sent you as an ambassador?
Orianne paused.
He didn't exactly send me, Your Majesty.
Oh, dear, Breeze said, pulling out a handkerchief to dab his brow.
Elland glanced at Ham, then back at the girl.
Perhaps you should explain, he said, gesturing toward the atrium's seats.
Orianne nodded eagerly, but stayed close to Breeze as they sat. Elland waved for some servants to bring chilled wine. He had a feeling he was going to want something to drink.
I seek asylum, Your Majesty, Orianne said, speaking with a quick voice. I had to go. I mean, Breezy must have told you how my father is.
Breeze sat uncomfortably, and Orianne put an affectionate hand on his knee.
How your father is? Elland asked.
He is so manipulative, Orianne said. So demanding. He drove Breezy away, and I absolutely had to follow. I wouldn't spend another moment in that camp. A war camp. He brought me, a young lady, along with him to war. Why, do you know what it is like to be leered at by every passing soldier? Do you understand what it is like to live in a tent? We rarely had fresh water, Orianne continued, and I couldn't take a decent bath without fear of peeping soldiers. During our travels, there was dreadful nothing to do all day but sit in the carriage and bounce, bounce, bounce. Why, until Breezy came, I hadn't had a refined conversation in weeks. And then Father drove him away.
Because, Ham asked eagerly. Breeze coughed.
I had to get away, Your Majesty, Orianne said. You have to give me asylum. I know things that could help you. Like, I saw my father's camp. I'll bet you don't know that he is getting supplies from the cannery in Haverfrex. What do you think of that?
Impressive, Elland said hesitantly.
Orianne nodded curtly.
And you came to find Breeze? Elland asked.
Orianne flushed slightly, glancing to the side. However, when she spoke, she displayed little tact.
I had to see him again, Your Majesty. So charming. So wonderful. I wouldn't have expected Father to understand a man such as he.
I see, Elland said.
Please, Your Majesty, Orianne said. You have to take me in. Now that I've left Father, I have nowhere else to go.
You may stay, for a time at least, Elland said, nodding greetings to Doxon, who had entered through the atrium doors. But you've obviously had a difficult trip. Perhaps you would like an opportunity to refresh yourself?
Oh, I would much appreciate that, Your Majesty.
Elland eyed Caden, one of the palace stewards, who stood at the back of the room with other servants. He nodded. Rooms were prepared.
Then, Elland said, standing, Caden will lead you to some rooms. We will take dinner this evening at 7, and can speak again then.
Thank you, Your Majesty,
Orianne said, jumping up from her chair. She gave Breeze another hug, then stepped forward as if to do the same for Elland.
Fortunately, she thought better of it, instead allowing the servants to lead her away.
Elland sat. Breeze sighed deeply, leaning back in a wearied posture as Doxon walked forward, taking the girl's seat.
That was unexpected, Breeze noted.
There was an awkward pause, the atrium trees shifting slightly in the breeze from the balcony. Then, with a sharp bark, Ham began to laugh. The noise sparked Elland, and despite the danger, despite the gravity of the problem, he found himself laughing as well.
Oh, honestly, Breeze huffed, which only prompted them further.
Perhaps it was the sheer incongruity of the situation. Perhaps it was because he needed to release tension, but Elland found himself laughing so hard he almost fell from the chair.
Ham wasn't doing much better, and even Doxson cracked a smile.
"I fail to see the levity in this situation," Breeze said. "The daughter of Lord Set, a man who is currently besieging our home, just demanded asylum in the city. If Set wasn't determined to kill us before, he certainly will be now."
"I know," Ellen said, taking deep breaths. "I know. It's just... it's the image of you," Ham said, "being hugged by that courtly fluff cake. I can't think of anything more awkward than you being confronted by an irrational young woman."
"This throws another wrinkle into things," Doxson noted. "Although I'm not accustomed to you being the one to bring us a problem of this nature, Breeze. Honestly, I thought we would be able to avoid unplanned female attachments now that Kel is gone."
"This isn't my fault," Breeze said pointedly. "The girl's affection is completely misplaced."
"That's for sure," Ham mumbled.
"All right," a new voice said. "What was that pink thing I just passed in the hallway?"
Ellen turned to find Vin standing, arms folded in the atrium doorway.
"So quiet. Why does she walk stealthily even in the palace?"
She never wore shoes that clicked, never wore skirts that could rustle, and never had metal on her clothing that could clink or be pushed by allomancers.
"That wasn't pink, my dear," Breeze said. "That was red."
"Close enough," Vin said, walking forward. "She was bubbling to the servants about how hot her bath needed to be, and making certain they wrote down her favorite foods."
Breeze sighed.
"That's all, Rianne. We'll probably have to get a new pastry chef. Either that or have desserts ordered in. She's rather particular about her pastries."
"Orianne Set is the daughter of Lord Set," Ellen explained as Vin, ignoring the chairs, sat on the edge of a planter beside his chair, laying a hand on his arm. "Apparently she and Breeze are something of an item."
"Excuse me," Breeze huffed.
Vin, however, wrinkled her nose.
"That's disgusting, Breeze. You're old. She's young."
"There was no relationship," Breeze snapped. "Besides, I'm not that old. Nor is she that young."
"She sounded like she was about 12, Vin said.
Breeze rolled his eyes.
"Orianne was a child of the country court. A little innocent, a little spoiled, but she hardly deserves to be spoken of in that manner. She's actually quite witty, in the right circumstances."
"So was there anything between you?" Vin pressed.
"Of course not," Breeze said. "Well, not really. Nothing real. That could have been taken the wrong way. Was taken the wrong way, actually, once her father discovered. Anyway, who are you to talk, Vin? I seem to remember a certain young girl pining for an old Kelsier a few years back."
Ellen perked up at this. Vin flushed.
"I never pined over Kelsier."
"Not even at the beginning?" Breeze asked. "Come now, a dashing man like him. He saved you from being beaten by your old crew leader. Took you in?"
"You're a sick man," Vin declared, folding her arms. "Kelsier was like a father to me."
"Eventually, perhaps," Breeze said. "But..."
Ellen held up a hand.
"Enough," he said. "This line of discussion is useless."
Breeze snorted, but fell silent.
"Tyndall is right," Ellen thought. "They will listen to me if I act like I expect them to."
"We have to decide what to do," Ellen said.
"The daughter of the man threatening us could be a very powerful bargaining chip," Doxson said.
"You mean take her hostage?" Vin said, eyes narrowing.
Doxson shrugged.
"Someone has to state the obvious, Vin."
"Not really a hostage," Ham said. "She came to us, after all. Simply letting her stay could have the same effect as taking her hostage."
"That would risk antagonizing Set," Ellen said. "Our original plan was to make him think we're his ally."
"We could give her back then," Doxson said.
"That could get us a long way in the negotiations."
"And her request?" Breeze asked.
The girl wasn't happy in her father's camp. Shouldn't we at least consider her wishes?
All eyes turned toward Elland. He paused. Just a few weeks ago, they would have kept on arguing. It seemed strange that they should so quickly begin to look to him for decisions. Who was he? A man who had haphazardly ended up on the throne? A poor replacement for their brilliant leader? An idealist who hadn't considered the dangers his philosophies would bring? A fool? A child? An imposter? The best they had.
She stays, Elland said. For now. Perhaps we'll be forced to return her eventually, but this will make a useful distraction for Set's army. Let them sweat for a bit. It will only buy us more time.
The crew members nodded, and Breeze looked relieved.
I'll do what I can. Make the decisions as I see they must be made, Elland thought. Then accept the consequences.
He could trade words with the finest of philosophers, and had an impressive memory, nearly as good even as my own. Yet he was not argumentative.
22. Chaos and stability. The mist was both. Upon the land there was an empire. Within that empire were a dozen shattered kingdoms. Within those kingdoms were cities, towns, villages, plantations. And above them all, within them all, around them all, was the mist. It was more constant than the sun, for it could not be hidden by clouds. It was more powerful than the storms, for it would outlast any weather's fury. It was always there, changing, but eternal. Day was an impatient sigh, awaiting the night. When the darkness did come, however, Vin found that the mists did not calmer as they once had. Nothing seemed certain anymore. Once the night had been her refuge. Now she found herself glancing behind, watching for ghostly outlines. Once Elland had been her peace. But he was changing. Once she had been able to protect things she loved. But she was growing more and more afraid that the forces moving against Luthadel were beyond her capacity to stop. Nothing frightened her more than her own impotence. During her childhood, she had taken it for granted that she couldn't change things. But Kelsier had given her pride in herself. If she couldn't protect Elland, what good was she?
There are still some things I can do, she thought forcefully.
She crouched quietly on a ledge, mist-cloak tassels hanging down, waving slightly in the wind. Just below her, torches burned fitfully at the front of Keep Venture, illuminating a pair of Ham's guards. They stood alert in the swirling mists, showing impressive diligence. The guards wouldn't be able to see her sitting just above them. They'd barely be able to see 20 feet in the thick mists. They weren't allomancers. Besides the core crew, Elland had access to barely half a dozen mistings, which made him allomantically weak compared with most of the other new kings in the Final Empire. Vin was supposed to make up the difference. The torches flickered as the doors opened and a figure left the palace. Ham's voice echoed quietly in the mist as he greeted his guards. One reason, perhaps the main reason that the guards were so diligent, was because of Ham. He might have been a bit of an anarchist at heart, but he could be a very good leader if he was given a small team. Though his guards weren't the most disciplined, polished soldiers Vin had seen, they were fiercely loyal. Ham talked with the men for a time, then he waved farewell and walked out into the mists. The small courtyard between the keep and its wall contained a couple of guard posts and patrols, and Ham would visit each one in turn. He walked boldly in the night, trusting to diffused starlight to see, rather than blinding himself with a torch. A thief's habit. Vin smiled, leaping quietly to the ground, then scampering after Ham. He walked on, ignorant of her presence. What would it be like to have only one allomantic power, Vin thought. To be able to make yourself stronger, but to have ears as weak as those of any normal man.
It had been only 2 years, but already she had come to rely so heavily on her abilities. Ham continued forward, Vin following discreetly until they reached the ambush. Vin tensed, flaring her bronze. Orsier howled suddenly, jumping from a pile of boxes. The Chondra was a dark silhouette in the night, his inhuman baying disturbing even to Vin. Ham spun, cursing quietly, and he instinctively flared pewter. Focused on her bronze, Vin confirmed that the pulses were definitely coming from him. Ham spun around, searching in the night as Orsier landed. Vin, however, simply smiled. Ham's allomancy meant he wasn't the imposter. She could cross another name off her list.
"It's okay, Ham," Vin said, walking forward.
Ham paused, lowering his dueling cane.
"Vin?" he asked, squinting in the mist.
"It's me," she said. "I'm sorry you startled my hound. He can get jumpy at night."
Ham relaxed.
"We all can, I guess. Anything happening tonight?"
"Not that I can tell," she said. "I'd let you know."
Ham nodded.
"I'd appreciate it, though I doubt you'd need me. I'm captain of the guard, but you're the one who does all the work."
"You're more valuable than you think, Ham," Vin said. "Elland confides in you. Since Jastis and the others left him, he's needed a friend."
Ham nodded. Vin turned, glancing into the mists where Orsier sat waiting on his haunches. He seemed to be getting more and more comfortable with his hound's body. Now that she knew Ham was not an imposter, there was something she needed to discuss with him.
"Ham," she said, "your protection of Elland is more valuable than you know."
"You're talking about the imposter," Ham said quietly. "El has me searching through the palace staff to see who might have gone missing for a few hours on that day. It's a tough task, though."
She nodded.
"There's something else, Ham. I'm out of Atium."
He stood quietly in the mists for a moment, and then she heard him mutter a curse.
"I'll die the next time I fight a Mistborn," she said.
"Not unless he has Atium," Ham said.
"What are the chances that someone would send a Mistborn without Atium to fight me?"
He hesitated.
"Ham," she said, "I need to find a way to fight against someone who is burning Atium.
Tell me that you know a way."
Ham shrugged in the darkness.
"There are lots of theories, Vin. I once had a long conversation with Breeze about this, though he spent most of it grumbling that I was annoying him."
"Well," Vin asked, "what can I do?"
He rubbed his chin.
"Most people agree that the best way to kill a Mistborn with Atium is to surprise them."
"That doesn't help if they attack me first," Vin said.
"Well," Ham said, "barring surprise, there isn't much. Some people think that you might be able to kill an Atium using Mistborn if you catch them in an unavoidable situation. It's like a game of fets. Sometimes the only way to take a piece is to corner it so that no matter which way it moves, it dies. Doing that to a Mistborn is pretty tough, though. The thing is, Atium lets the Mistborn see the future, so he knows when a move will trap him, and so he can avoid the situation. The metal is supposed to enhance his mind somehow, too."
"It does. When I'm burning Atium, I often dodge before I even register the attacks that are coming."
Ham nodded.
"So," Vin said, "what else?"
"That's it, Vin," Ham said. "Thugs talk about this topic a lot. We're all afraid of going up against a Mistborn. Those are your two options. Surprise him, or overwhelm him. I'm sorry."
Vin frowned. Neither option would do her much good if she got ambushed.
"Anyway, I need to keep moving. I promise to tell you about any corpses I produce."
Ham laughed.
"How about you just try and avoid getting into situations where you have to produce them, eh? The Lord only knows what this kingdom would do if we lost you."
Vin nodded, though she wasn't certain how much Ham could see of her in the darkness. She waved to Orsier, heading out toward the keep wall, leaving Ham on the cobbled path.
"Mistress," Orsier said as they reached the top of the wall.
Might I know the purpose of surprising Master Hammond like that? Are you that fond of startling your friends?
It was a test, Vin said, pausing beside a Merlin gap, looking out over the city proper.
A test, mistress.
To see if he would use allomancy. That way I could know that he wasn't the impostor.
Ah, the Chandra said. Clever, mistress.
Vin smiled. Thank you, she said. A guard patrol was moving toward them. Not wanting to have to deal with them, Vin nodded to the wall-top stone guardhouse. She jumped, pushing off a coin, and landed on top of it. Orsieur bounded up beside her, using his strange Chandra musculature to leap the 10 feet. Vin sat down cross-legged to think, and Orsieur padded over to the roof's side and lay down, his paws hanging over the edge. As they sat, Vin considered something.
Orsieur told me that a Chandra didn't gain allomantic powers if he ate an allomancer. But can a Chandra be an allomancer on his own? I never did finish that conversation.
This will tell me if a person isn't a Chandra, won't it? Vin asked, turning to Orsieur. Your people don't have allomantic powers, right?
Orsieur didn't answer.
Orsieur? Vin said.
I'm not required to answer that question, mistress.
Yes, Vin thought with a sigh. The contract. How am I supposed to catch this other Chandra if Orsieur won't answer any of my questions?
She leaned back in frustration, staring up into the endless mists, using her mist cloak to cushion her head.
Your plan will work, mistress, Orsieur said quietly.
Vin paused, rolling her head to look at him. He lay with head on forepaws, staring over the city.
If you sense allomancy from someone, then they aren't a Chandra.
Vin sensed a hesitant reluctance to his words, and he didn't look at her. It was as if he spoke grudgingly, giving up information that he'd rather have kept to himself.
So secretive, Vin thought. Thank you, she said.
Orsieur shrugged a pair of canine shoulders.
I know you'd rather not have to deal with me, she said. We'd both rather keep our distance from each other. But we'll just have to make things work this way.
Orsieur nodded again, then turned his head slightly and looked at her.
Why is it that you hate me?
I don't hate you, Vin said.
Orsieur raised a canine eyebrow. There was a wisdom in those eyes, an understanding that Vin was surprised to see. She'd never seen such things in him before. Vin trailed off, looking away.
I just haven't ever gotten over the fact that you ate Kelsier's body.
That isn't it, Orsieur said, turning back to look at the city. You're too smart to be bothered by that.
Vin frowned indignantly, but the Chandra wasn't looking at her. She turned, staring back up at the mists.
Why did he bring this up? She thought. We were just starting to get along.
She'd been willing to forget.
You really want to know? She thought. Fine. It's because you knew, she whispered.
Excuse me, mistress.
You knew,
Vin said, still looking into the mists.
You were the only one on the crew who knew Kelsier was going to die. He told you that he was going to let himself be killed, and that you were to take his bones.
Ah, Orsieur said quietly.
Vin turned accusing eyes at the creature.
Why didn't you say anything? You knew how we felt about Kelsier. Did you even consider telling us that the idiot planned to kill himself? Did it even cross your mind that we might be able to stop him? That we might be able to find another way?
You are being quite harsh, mistress.
Well, you wanted to know, Vin said. It was worst right after he died, when you came to be my servant by his order. You never even spoke of what you'd done.
The contract, mistress, Orsieur said. You do not wish to hear this, perhaps, but I was bound. Kelsier did not wish you to know of his plans, so I could not tell you. Hate me if you must, but I do not regret my actions.
I don't hate you. I got over that. But honestly, you wouldn't even break the contract for his own good? You served Kelsier for 2 years. Didn't it even hurt you to know he was going to die?
Why should I care if one master or another dies? Orsier said. There is always another to take their place.
Kelsier wasn't that kind of master, Vin said.
Wasn't he?
No.
I apologize, mistress, Orsier said. I will believe as commanded, then.
Vin opened her mouth to reply, then snapped it closed. If he was determined to keep thinking like a fool, then it was his right to do so. He could continue to resent masters just as she resented him. For keeping his word, for holding to his contract.
Ever since I've known him, I've done nothing but treat him poorly, Vin thought. First when he was Renu, I reacted against his haughty bearing. But that bearing wasn't his, it was part of the act he had to play. Then, as Orsier, I avoided him, hated him even, for letting Kelsier die. Now I've forced him into an animal's body. And in 2 years of knowing him, the only times I've asked about his past, I did it so that I could glean more information about his people so that I could find the imposter.
Vin watched the mists. Of all the people in the crew, only Orsier had been an outsider. He hadn't been invited to their conferences. He hadn't inherited a position in the government. He'd helped as much as any of them, playing a vital role, that of the spirit of Kelsier, who had returned from the grave to incite the Ska to their final rebellion. Yet while the rest of them had titles, friendships, and duties, the only thing Orsier had gained from overthrowing the final empire was another master. One who hated him.
No wonder he reacts like he does, Vin thought.
Kelsier's last words to her returned to her mind.
You have a lot to learn about friendship, Vin.
Kel and the others had invited her in, treated her with dignity and friendliness, even when she hadn't deserved it.
Orsier, she said, what was your life like before you were recruited by Kelsier?
I don't see what that has to do with finding the imposter, mistress, Orsier said.
It doesn't have anything to do with that, Vin said. I just thought maybe I should get to know you better.
My apologies, mistress, but I don't want you to know me.
Vin sighed.
So much for that.
But, well, Kelsier and the others hadn't turned away when she'd been blunt with them. There was a familiar tone to Orsier's words, something in them that she recognized.
Anonymity, Vin said quietly.
Mistress?
Anonymity. Hiding, even when you're with others. Being quiet, unobtrusive. Forcing yourself to stay apart, emotionally at least. It's a way of life, a protection.
Orsier didn't answer.
You serve beneath masters, Vin said. Harsh men who fear your competence. The only way to keep them from hating you is to make certain they don't pay attention to you. So you make yourself look small and weak, not a threat. But sometimes you say the wrong thing, or you let your rebelliousness show.
She turned toward him. He was watching her.
Yes, he finally said, turning to look back over the city.
They hate you, Vin said quietly. They hate you because of your powers, because they can't make you break your word, or because they worry that you are too strong to control.
They become afraid of you, Orsier said. They grow paranoid, terrified, even as they use you, that you will take their place. Despite the contract, despite knowing that no Chandra would break his sacred vow, they fear you.
and men hate what they fear.
And so, Vin said, they find excuses to beat you. Sometimes even your efforts to remain harmless seem to provoke them. They hate your skill. They hate the fact that they don't have more reasons to beat you, so they beat you.
Orsier turned back to her. How do you know these things? He demanded. Vin shrugged.
That's not only how they treat Chandra, Orsier. That's the same way crew leaders treat a young girl. An anomaly in a thieving underground filled with men. A child who had a strange ability to make things happen. To influence people. To hear what she shouldn't. To move more quietly and quickly than others. A tool, yet a threat at the same time.
I didn't realize, Mistress.
Vin frowned. How could he not have known about my past? He knew I was a street urchin.
Except, had he?
For the first time, Vin realized how Orsier must have seen her 2 years before when she'd first met him. He had arrived in the area after her recruitment. He probably assumed that she'd been part of Kelsier's team for years, like the others.
Kelsier recruited me for the first time just a few days before I met you, Vin said. Well, actually, he didn't so much recruit me as rescue me. I spent my childhood serving in one thieving crew after another, always working for the least reputable and most dangerous men, for those were the only ones who would take in a couple of transients like my brother and me. The smart crew leaders learned that I was a good tool. I'm not sure if they figured out that I was an allomancer. Some probably did. Others just thought I was lucky. Either way, they needed me. And that made them hate me.
So they beat you? Vin nodded.
The last one especially. That was when I was really beginning to figure out how to use allomancy, even though I didn't know what it was. Kamen knew, though. And he hated me even as he used me. I think he was afraid that I would figure out how to use my powers fully. And on that day he worried that I would kill him.
Vin turned her head, looking at Orsier. Kill him and take his place as crew leader. Orsier sat quietly, up on his haunches now, regarding her.
Chandra aren't the only ones that humans treat poorly, Vin said quietly. We're pretty good at abusing each other, too.
Orsier snorted. With you, at least, they had to hold back for fear they'd kill you. Have you ever been beaten by a master who knows that no matter how hard he hits you, you won't die? All he has to do is get you a new set of bones, and you'll be ready to serve again the next day. We are the ultimate servant. You can beat us to death in the morning, then have us serve you dinner that night. All the sadism, none of the cost.
Vin closed her eyes.
I understand. I wasn't a Chandra, but I did have pewter. I think Kamen knew he could beat me far harder than he should have been able to.
Why didn't you run? Orsier asked. You didn't have a contract bonding you to him.
I don't know, Vin said. People are strange, Orsier, and loyalty is so often twisted. I stayed with Kamen because he was familiar, and I feared leaving more than I did staying. That crew was all I had. My brother was gone, and I was terrified of being alone. It seems kind of strange now, thinking back.
Sometimes a bad situation is still better than the alternative. You did what you needed to do to survive.
Perhaps, Vin said. But there's a better way, Orsier. I didn't know it until Kelsier found me. But life doesn't have to be like that. You don't have to spend your years mistrusting, staying in the shadows and keeping yourself apart.
Perhaps if you are human, I am Chandra.
You can still trust, Vin said. You don't have to hate your masters.
I don't hate them all, Mistress.
But you don't trust them.
It is nothing personal, mistress.
Yes, it is, Vin said. You don't trust us because you're afraid we'll hurt you. I understand that. I spent months with Kelsier wondering when I was going to get hurt again.
She paused.
But, Orsier, nobody betrayed us. Kelsier was right. It seems incredible to me even now, but the men in this crew, Ham, Doxson, Breeze, they're good people. And even if one of them were to betray me, I'd still rather have trusted them. I can sleep at night, Orsier. I can feel peace. I can laugh. Life is different. Better.
You are human, Orsier said stubbornly. You can have friends because they don't worry that you'll eat them, or some other foolishness.
I don't think that about you.
Don't you? Mistress, you just admitted that you resent me because I ate Kelsier. Beyond that, you hate the fact that I followed my contract. You at least have been honest. Human beings find us disturbing. They hate that we eat their kind, even though we only take bodies that are already dead. Your people find it unsettling that we can take their forms. Don't tell me that you haven't heard the legends of my people. Mistwraiths, they call us. Creatures that steal the shapes of men who go into the mists. You think a monster like that, a legend used to frighten children, will ever find acceptance in your society?
Vin frowned.
This is the reason for the contract, mistress, Orsier said, his muffled voice harsh as he spoke through dog's lips. You wonder why we don't just run away from you, meld into your society and become unseen? We tried that, long ago when the Final Empire was new. Your people found us, and they started to destroy us. They used Mistborn to hunt us down, for there were many more Allomancers in those days. Your people hated us because they feared we would replace them. We were almost completely destroyed. And then we came up with the contract.
But what difference does that make? Vin asked. You're still doing the same things, aren't you?
Yes, but now we do them at your command, Orsier said. Men like power, and they love controlling something powerful. Our people offered to serve, and we devised a binding contract, one that every Chondra vowed to uphold. We will not kill men. We will take bones only when we are commanded. We will serve our masters with absolute obedience. We began to do these things, and men stopped killing us. They still hated and feared us, but they also knew they could command us. We became your tools. As long as we remain subservient, mistress, we survive. And that is why I obey. To break the contract would be to betray my people. We cannot fight you, not while you have Mistborn, and so we must serve you.
Mistborn. Why are Mistborn so important? He implied that they could find Chondra.
She kept this tidbit to herself. She sensed that if she pointed it out, he'd close up again. So instead, she sat up and met his eyes in the darkness.
If you wish, I will free you from your contract.
And what would that change? Orsior asked. I'd just get another contract. By our laws, I must wait another decade before I have time for freedom. And then, only 2 years, during which time I won't be able to leave the Chondra homeland. To do otherwise would risk exposure.
Then, at least accept my apology, she asked. I was foolish to resent you for following your contract.
Orsier paused.
That still doesn't fix things, mistress. I still have to wear this cursed dog's body. I have no personality or bones to imitate.
I'd think that you would appreciate the opportunity simply to be yourself.
I feel naked, Orsier said.
He sat quietly for a moment, then he bowed his head.
But I have to admit there are advantages to these bones. I didn't realize how unobtrusive they would make me.
Vin nodded. There were times in my life when I would have given anything to be able to take the form of a dog and just live my life being ignored.
But not anymore.
Vin shook her head. No. Not most of the time, anyway. I used to think that everyone was like you say, hateful, hurtful. But there are good people in the world, Orsier. I wish I could prove that to you.
You speak of this king of yours, Orsier said, glancing toward the keep.
Yes, Vin said. And others.
You?
Vin shook her head. No, not me. I'm not a good person or a bad person. I'm just here to kill things.
Orsier watched her for a moment, then settled back down.
Regardless, he said, you are not my worst master. That is perhaps a compliment among our people.
Vin smiled, but her own words left her a bit haunted.
Just here to kill things.
She glanced toward the light of the armies outside the city. A part, the part that had been trained by Reen, the part that still occasionally used his voice in the back of her mind, whispered that there was another way to fight these armies. Rather than rely on politics and parleys, the crew could use Vin. Send her on a quiet visit into the night that left the kings and generals of the armies dead. But she knew that Elend wouldn't approve of something like that. He'd argue against using fear to motivate, even on one's enemies. He'd point out that if she killed Straff or Set, they'd just be replaced by other men, men even more hostile toward the city. Even so, it seemed like such a brutal, logical answer. A piece of Vin itched to do it, if only to be doing something other than waiting and talking. She was not a person meant to be besieged.
No, she thought, that's not my way. I don't have to be like Kelsier was. Hard. Unyielding. I can be something better. Something that trusts in Ellen's way.
She shoved aside that part of her that wanted to just go assassinate both Straff and Set, then turned her attention to other things. She focused on her bronze, watching for signs of allomancy. Though she liked to jump around and patrol the area, the truth was that she was just as effective staying in one place. Assassins would be likely to scout the front gates, for that was where patrols began, and the largest concentration of soldiers waited. Still, she felt her mind wandering. There were forces moving in the world, and Vin wasn't certain if she wanted to be part of them.
What is my place? She thought.
She never felt that she'd discovered it, not back when she'd been playing as Valette Renu, and not now when she acted as the bodyguard to the man she loved. Nothing quite fit. She closed her eyes, burning tin and bronze, feeling the touch of wind-borne mist on her skin. And oddly, she felt something else. Something very faint. In the distance, she could sense allomantic pulsings. They were so dull, she almost missed them. They were kind of like the pulses given off by the mist spirit. She could hear it, too, much closer, atop a building out in the city. She was getting used to its presence, not that she had much choice. Still, as long as it only watched.
It tried to kill one of the hero's companions, she thought. It knifed him somehow.
Or so the logbook claimed.
But what was that pulsing in the far distance? It was soft, yet powerful, like a faraway drum.
She squeezed her eyes shut, focusing.
Mistress, Orsier said, suddenly perking up.
Vin snapped her eyes open.
What?
Didn't you hear that?
Vin sat up.
What?
Then she picked it out. Footsteps outside the wall a short distance away. She leaned closer, noticing a dark figure walking down the street toward the keep. She'd been so focused on her bronze that she'd completely tuned out real sounds.
Good job, she said, approaching the edge of the guard station's roof. Only then did she realize something important. Orsieur had taken the initiative. He'd alerted her of the danger without specifically being ordered to listen. It was a small thing, but it seemed important. What do you think? She asked quietly, watching the figure approach. He carried no torch, and he seemed very comfortable in the mists.
Allomancer? Orsieur asked, crouching beside her.
Vin shook her head.
There's no allomantic pulse.
So if he is one, he's mistborn, Orsieur said.
He still didn't know she could pierce copper clouds.
He's too tall to be your friend Zane. Be careful, mistress.
Vin nodded, dropped a coin, then threw herself into the mists. Behind her, Orsieur jumped down from the guardhouse, then leapt off the wall and dropped some 20 feet to the ground.
He certainly does like to push the limits of those bones, she thought.
Of course, if a fall couldn't kill him, then she could perhaps understand his courage. She guided herself by pulling on the nails in a wooden roof, landing just a short distance from the dark figure. She pulled out her knives and prepared her medals, making certain she had Duralumin. Then she moved quietly across the street.
Surprise, she thought.
Ham's suggestion still left her nervous. She couldn't always depend on surprise. She followed the man, studying him. He was tall, very tall, and in robes. In fact, those robes... Vin stopped short.
Says it?
She asked with shock. The terraceman turned, face now visible to her tin-enhanced eyes. He smiled.
Ah, Lady Vin, he said with his familiar, wise voice. I was beginning to wonder how long it would take you to find me. You are...
He was cut off as Vin grabbed him in an excited embrace.
I didn't think you were going to come back so soon.
I was not planning to return, Lady Vin, Sazed said. But events are such that I could not avoid this place, I think. Come, we must speak with His Majesty. I have news of a rather disconcerting nature.
Vin let go, looking up at his kindly face, noting the tiredness in his eyes. Exhaustion. His robes were dirty and smelled of ash and sweat. Sazed was usually very meticulous, even when he traveled.
What is it? She asked. Problems, Lady Vin, he said quietly. Problems and troubles.
The Terrace rejected him, but he came to lead them.
23.
King Lekal claimed that he had 20,000 of the creatures in his army, Sazed said quietly.
20,000, Elend thought in shock. That was easily as dangerous as Straff's 50,000 men. Probably more so. The table fell silent, and Elend glanced at the others. They sat in the palace kitchen, where a couple of cooks hurriedly prepared a late-night dinner for Sazed. The white room had an alcove at the side with a modest table for servant meals. Not surprisingly, Elend had never dined in the room, but Sazed had insisted that they not wake the servants it would require to prepare the main dining hall, though he apparently hadn't eaten all day. So they sat on the low wooden benches, waiting while the cooks worked, far enough away that they couldn't hear the hushed conversation in the alcove. Vin sat beside Elend, arm around his waist, her wolfhound Chandra on the floor beside her. Breeze sat on the other side of him, looking disheveled. He'd been rather annoyed when they'd woken him. Ham had already been up, as had Elend himself. Another proposal had needed work, a letter he would send to the assembly explaining that he was meeting with Straff informally, rather than in official parley. Doxon pulled over a stool, choosing a place away from Elend as usual. Clubs sat slumped on his side of the bench, though Elend couldn't tell if the posture was from weariness or from General Club's grumpiness. That left only Spook, who sat on one of the serving tables a distance away, legs swinging over the side as he occasionally pilfered a tidbit of food from the annoyed cooks. He was, Elend noticed with amusement, flirting quite unsuccessfully with a drowsy kitchen girl.
And then there was Sazed. The terraceman sat directly across from Elland, with the calm sense of collectedness that only Sazed could manage. His robes were dusty, and he looked odd without his earrings, removed to not tempt thieves, Elland would guess. But his face and hands were clean. Even dirtied from travel, Sazed still gave off a sense of tidiness.
"I do apologize, Your Majesty," Sazed said. "But I do not think that Lord Lekal is trustworthy. I realize that you were friends with him before the collapse, but his current state seems somewhat unstable."
Elland nodded. "How is he controlling them, you think?" Sazed shook his head.
"I cannot guess, Your Majesty."
Ham shook his head.
"I have men in the guard who came up from the south after the collapse. They were soldiers serving in a garrison near a Kolos camp. The Lord Ruler hadn't been dead a day before the creatures went crazy. They attacked everything in the area, villages, garrisons, cities."
"The same happened in the northwest," Breeze said. "Lord Set's lands were being flooded with refugees running from rogue Kolos. Set tried to recruit the Kolos garrison near his own lands, and they followed him for a time, but then something set them off, and they just attacked his army. He had to slaughter the whole lot, and nearly lost 2,000 soldiers, killing a small garrison of 500 Kolos."
The group grew quiet again, the clacking and talking of the cooking staff sounding a short distance away.
500 Kolos killed 2,000 men, Elland thought, and the Jasti's force contains 20,000 of the beasts. Lord Ruler. "How long?" said Clubs. "How far away?"
"It took me a little over a week to get here," Sazed said, "though it looked as if King Lekal had been camped there for a time. He is obviously coming this direction, but I don't know how quickly he intends to march."